Welcome to Mayo Clinic Educator Central, brought to you by the eLearning Center at Mayo Clinic. Today, I am thrilled to have with us on the show author and instructional design all-star, Julie Dirksen. Julie is the author of the excellent book, Designed for How People Learn, which I personally recommend to everyone from novice to experts in education. She has her MS in instructional design and has worked with large corporations, small nonprofits, tech startups, higher education institutions, and everything in between. Julie also teaches workshops and courses on a variety of education topics, including the things we're going to be talking about today. So with that being said, so Julie, quick question for you to get us started. True, false. Human attention span is shorter than a goldfish.
I don't know if it's a short question. The answer to that is almost certainly that's completely nonsense. And it's a fact that's gotten fact with heavy air quotes that's gotten bandied around. As far as anybody can tell, and I'm not the only person who's tried to track this down, that piece of information stemmed from a website called Statistic Brain, which I believe is now behind a paywall, but used to be freely accessible. And they claimed that human attention span had gone from, oh gosh, I think it was about 12 seconds in the mid-2000s down to like 8.25 seconds, and that a goldfish attention span was 9 seconds. And so therefore, human attention span was now shorter than a goldfish. There were some references cited on the website, but none of them actually talked about goldfish really at all. And they barely talked about kind of human attention span. And so when we look at that, like a bunch of questions kind of spring to mind. The first one that I always want to know is, how do you operationally measure goldfish attention span? Because it's not like you can, right, you know, sort of survey goldfish. And so like, what does that actually mean when we say goldfish attention span? Is it like how long they'll pay attention to something like food if you put it in their bowl, or how long is it before they like turn around and swim the other way? And how, if they do turn around and swim the other way, how do we know it's because their attention span ended and not just because they were bored or because...
How can you tell if they're paying attention to food? I don't even... Yeah.
Yeah. No. I don't think there is. I mean, it is entirely possible that the people who study goldfish, and I'm sure they exist, could tell you something about goldfish attention span. Mm-hmm. But the idea that somehow those measures would have anything to do with human attention span is just laughable at that point. So that's the first problem. The second problem is actually, what do we even mean when we say human attention span? Because we use that term like we all understand what it means. But if you really break it down, what are we talking about? So one definition, which may be, you know, 8 or 9 seconds for humans, is how long you can kind of focus on something before like a stray thought crosses your mind. But the issue with that is that you have stray thoughts crossing your mind all the time. That doesn't mean you can't still focus on a learning experience or a piece of work or something that you're doing or whatever. You know, like you can be focusing on reading something very carefully, and then you have a brief thought about lunch, and then you keep reading. Mm-hmm. And so that measure of how long before, you know, you think of something else is probably not relevant for any of the things that we concern ourselves for around task performance or ability to focus on a learning experience or any of those kinds of things. So that's basically not relevant for our purposes. It could be how long like somebody will focus on something before they're like, I'm tired of looking at that, I'm going to look at something else. Mm-hmm. So it's like if you're browsing the web or you're looking at Facebook, how long do you look at one post before you get distracted by something else, you know, that's shiny or moving on the page and shift your attention off? And that's, of course, of great concern to marketing people. And the reason that this particular myth about goldfish attention span got propagated is that that fact from Statistic Brain got used in a white paper by the Microsoft Canada marketing department. And mm-hmm. the marketing department had actually done some research in terms of how long people would look at their marketing materials before they would move on. And they had done things like galvanic skin response and I don't know if they did EEGs, but they did actually quite a few measures around people's responses to Microsoft's marketing materials. And those were all legitimate studies that had, you know, decent study design. There was some legitimate information about how people responded to like their attention span for marketing materials from Microsoft that they specifically studied. Now, whether those results are generalizable to other kinds of marketing materials, who knows? And none of it tested learning materials. So basically everything about that fact was essentially irrelevant. But because it showed up in a Microsoft white paper, somehow it got picked up by some of the traditional press. So Time Magazine cited it, the Wall Street Journal had it, Guardian newspaper, you know, a bunch of different sources had
lent it some legitimacy, basically.
Right. And that fact was always attributed to Microsoft research, quote unquote. Despite the fact that the white paper contained some legitimate research, this goldfish fact was just a part of a little intro that somebody wrote for the white paper and was not borne out or substantiated by any of the research that Microsoft actually did. So, you know, so none of this stuff means anything. And when we're concerned with, you know, attention span from a learning point of view, we're concerned with how long somebody can stay focused on something, right? How long can I stay focused on something that I'm learning? So how long can I stay focused in a class, or how long can I stay focused in e-learning or something along those kinds of things? And, you know, we hear a lot of numbers that get thrown out, which is 7 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, there have been studies. So one study, which John Medina cites in his book, Brain Rules, suggests that if students are taking notes in a lecture class, the quality of those notes will drop off noticeably after about 10 minutes.
Right. It's so interesting that you bring that up. There's a study of literature that was done in 2016 in the Advanced Physiology Education Journal called Attention Span During Lectures, 8 seconds, 10 seconds or more. And they're trying to dig into, like, where does this myth of the, like, sort of 10 to 15 minute attention span come from? And and they did trace it back to what you were mentioning, which is a 1978 article, which is not even a primary resource, that is not about attention span, but about note taking and note taking dropping off. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the attention span or that had anything really to do with attentions. They just took less notes. And
yeah. Well, I mean, you have to define your terms for us to agree on what we mean by these things. Like, if you're not being specific about this is the operational definition of attention span that we're using, then all of these numbers are essentially meaningless. Which is funny, because if you ask people, do you know what attention span means, almost everybody would say yes, but there are actually really different things that we mean when we say that term. So the counterexample that I always give, and you could do any number of pieces of media for this, but there's a movie theater near my house, and I don't know if they're still doing it, but they used to show like all of the Lord of the Rings movies back to back at Christmas time, and people loved this and would go, and it would sell out, and that's like 13 hours of movies, you know, and getting a little break in between. But I mean, like, the fact that somebody can, if they're passionate about something, they can allocate their attention for 13 hours. And we've seen this with binge watching Netflix shows or playing video games. Like, there is no reason to believe that there is a finite capacity to our ability to pay attention to something. And we have all of these counterexamples around us in the world. Now, eventually you're going to get tired and hungry and, you know, have to go to sleep or things like that. But, like, you know, aside from those limitations, if we are passionate about it, or if we're interested in it, or, you know, if it's something we want to pay attention to, it seems like there's no actual practical limit to how long we can pay attention to something. Now, granted, movie makers or video game designers or the people who make the Netflix, like the really bingy Netflix shows, you know a lot about making sure that they keep you engaged. Yeah. So it's done in a skillful manner. But if that exists, then there's no finite capacity in the person typically. You know, there's probably some individual differences in terms of, you know, whether somebody's...
Right. But when we say, like, that humans can only pay attention for 10 to 15 minutes to somebody talking, you know, like, as a general rule, that there really is no grounds for that or any kind of anything for that to hold on to. And in this article that I just mentioned a little bit ago, this is a pretty good article because it digs into all of the sort of myths about attention span, all the varieties of research that have been done that have tried to somehow define and put that limit around attention span. But what's great about it is that its summary is that none of this is valid. You know, there really is nothing to it. And that the source of it all, of really kind of what you're saying, and this connects to the Lord of the Rings sort of example, is that people's engagement and attention to something that they're learning is rooted in whether or not, basically, they have two factors that they find are associated to attention, which are arousal and motivation. And I think those are two you know, those are vague terms in some ways, but they mean to, you know, there's a lot of things we can do to engage those things, you know, in people. And I don't know about you, but I see a lot of this belief in the 10 to 15 minute myth. And because of that, I see a lot of people reacting to that, using this as a guiding tool. For instance, maybe somebody taking a, you know, 1 or 2 hour lecture and not changing really anything about that lecture. And they just cut that up into maybe 10, 15 minute segments and then believe that that is going to sort of change the result. And it really doesn't. In fact, I think it might even make some learners more upset, you know, that they have to quit.
Right. And there's been a real passion in the industry for microlearning. And I think there are lots of things you can do with microlearning that are fine. It's great for performance support. Fantastic. Keep it short and, you know, succinct, because people are going and looking just for the answer to the one particular question. And a 3-minute video might be exactly what they need in that circumstance. Or it might be a 9-minute video because it's a complicated thing. You know, it just depends. And so there's that, there's the issue of, I do think that there may be some limits to how long people can kind of force themselves to pay attention to something that's fundamentally not interesting. We were talking about like release forms and legal paperwork before we got started on it. And I know that like when I have to read a contract that has a lot of legalese in it, I'm going to have to force myself to do that. My ability to do that, like I probably couldn't read legal contracts for like 2 hours straight. Like my eyes would cross and I'd, you know, need to have, you know, like go have a snack or something and, you know, do those sorts of things. And so what we may be hitting when we hit some of these capacities is, I think you're going to be learning something that's fundamentally not interesting to you, and I'm going to ask you to force yourself to pay attention, and that capacity may be limited. You know, if we're interested, unlimited, basically. But if we're not interested, then maybe that 10-minute mark or, you know, something like that, probably depending on a lot of factors, like did people sleep well the night before and did they have breakfast and how motivated are they by extrinsic factors if they're not motivated intrinsically, and all of these kinds of questions start to kind of come into play. But that may be something. You know, there was a lot going on around Roy Baumeister's ego depletion work, and now it's come under some real issues in terms of replicability. So but he was positing the theory that willpower was kind of an exhaustible resource, and then once you kind of used it up, you had to sort of recharge the batteries before you'd have more. And that idea, like I said, has come under some real skeptical stuff. But you know, that notion of I can force myself to do this, and that may be where some of these limits are coming from.
Right. You mentioned micro learning, but when I think of micro learning, I think that it can sometimes is a phrase that can be misunderstood and applied incorrectly. So if you're doing micro learning, you think it really just means like chopping up something into 5, 10 minute segments, and that's really all your strategy is. To me, that's not really a well-designed micro-learning strategy. In order to do well-designed micro-learning, you should be, you know, really hitting on a lot of the things that engage people. It's part of a larger design strategy, not just a parameter of make things short, you know?
Yeah. Well, and you know, the issue there is one of the best things I've ever seen about microlearning, and I'm still not 100% sure I think microlearning is actually a thing. I think it might be a technique, but it's not a, you know, it's not a thing in and of itself. But one of the best things I've seen about it is the idea that, you know, if you're really trying to do this microlearning, each thing should be a kind of comprehensive thought in and of itself. It's not that I'm going to take something that was 20 minutes and chop it into 3-minute chunks, but you still don't get the complete thought until you're through the whole 20 minutes and things like that. I view it with a lot of skepticism because, like I said, I'm not sure how it's different from performance support, which we've been doing for decades. And I'm not sure.
Performance support. What do you mean when you say that? What does that mean to you?
Basically, in a lot of cases, I mean, it depends, but in a lot of cases, we're talking about some kind of just-in-time intervention. So I learned this thing. I learned how to, oh gosh, I learned how to, you know, process this, you know, claims paperwork or something in my class, and I learned the whole thing from start to finish. But there's this weird exception case that only shows up like once a month. And so when I get to my weird exception case, I go, darn it, I don't remember how to do it from the class. And so what some, you know, thoughtful instructional designer has done is said, here's, you know, here's a little 5-minute 5-minute video that'll explain what to, how to handle this exception case and some job aids for you, you know, some reference materials for you to use. So instead of having to, you know, go back and dig through your materials, you have this easily accessible thing that you can do in 5 minutes that just helps you deal with this exception case that you haven't looked at in a really long time. Things that help you perform in the moment as opposed to some kind of learning experience that's separate from performance.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
You know, the example or the way that I always explain this is I'll sometimes ask a group that I'm talking to, how many people right now are interested in a 5-minute video about printer repair? and on a scale of 0 to 10, where are you? And, you know, generally speaking, the room will be 0, except maybe occasionally I get a printer wonk who's like, yeah, I'd watch it, you know. But by and large, it's 0, right? Now, the next question is, okay, it's your printer. Your printer is broken and you have to print your application form or something by, you know, or your tax returns or whatever it is by midnight, and your printer is broken and it's
suddenly,
like 9:30.
Everybody's interested, right?
Right. And then all of a sudden you're like 8, 9, 10 in your level of interest in a 5-minute video about printer repair. And then I'm like, all right, so now let's take another hypothetical. You're all sitting here. I put a broken printer in front of you. And I say your task in this class or this talk or this workshop is to fix this printer. Now, how interested are you in the 5-minute video about printer repair for that printer? And, you know, people are like, 6, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the last example is performance support, right? It's the, I have a very specific need. This video will answer my need. And so people are, you know, like I said, 8, 9, 10 in terms of their desire to, you know, their interest in viewing it. But we can create that need by giving them an actual thing they need to solve in the classroom. And it won't be as high as if they have a real need, but at least it's something, right? It's better than 0.
Yeah.
And so that's when we get into things like scenario-based learning or problem-based learning or case-based learning or things like that. If I give you the problem to solve and I say this 5-minute video will help you solve it, then you're in, then it's not very difficult for you to pay attention to that video. If I say this video may help you solve a problem sometime in the future, we're not sure when, then your interest in watching that video is quite low, right? But if you have an immediate problem you need to solve, even if it's a fictional one that we created for the training class, your interest goes up by quite a bit. And the big issue with that is that we didn't change the video. It wasn't, engagement was not a product of the video. Now the video needs to be clear and easy to use and it needs to explain the things. So it has to be good in that sense, but you don't have to add, you know, unicorns and like cats playing pianos to it to attract the attention of your learners. They just have to have something that they can do with it immediately. And so that's one of the big things that I see when we, you know, you see like articles or talks sometimes about engagement is that the, you know, the strategies focus on things like maybe what marketers do to make it more engaging for people. And I don't think there's anything wrong with leveraging those things, but the real difference is going to be how interested is your, in your learner, in the material. And a lot of times that interest is going to be based on, can they use it? Can they do something with it?
Well, I think even in marketing, we see that. We see commercials or marketing that tries to create a problem or let you know that you have a problem that this product or service can solve. So,
exactly.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned engagement and also we hear a lot of the buzzword of sticky. You know, there's books out there make sticky learning. And I think this is something I've seen a lot. We've got to make learning stick and make it sticky. And there are a lot of different models or tactics that people propose to making things sticky. For instance, psychologist Stella Collins developed the acronym LEARNS for making learning sticky, where L is for linking, E is emotions, you know, engaging the learner's emotion. A is for anchor. R would be for repetition. We all hopefully know that repetition helps with long-term memory transfer. N would be novelty for, you know, changing things up and making them interesting. And then S would be stories, which of course engages a lot of the things that the LEARN already did. So So, and then in other sites, I've seen other types of, tactics mentioned. It seems like there's a variety. Stories seem to be a big one. And I'm very much for stories because I feel like they engage emotions. They put things in context. They do what you just said in that they give people an understanding of why they might need something. So if you create a story problem or something, like you're in this fake scenario and you know, you have to solve something, then suddenly the information becomes more interesting. But I also know that you're sort of a bit of a expert on sticky learning as well. What are some things that you might suggest for people to solve the issue of maybe their learner's not paying attention, and knowing now that it's not about how short or long it is, and human deficiencies in our ability to pay attention?
Yeah, well, you know, we tend to focus on things that we can use immediately. And so the sort of the most basic strategy really is that, like, give your learners some kind of problem that they need to solve, give them tools that will help them solve it, and then it's much easier for them to allocate their attention. Because there's a bunch of different versions of this. There's Daniel Kahneman's System One, System Two thinking. There's some different versions of it. The one that I always talk about is Jonathan Haidt's rider and the elephant metaphor, which is this idea that, you know, most of your brain is like the bigger parts of your brain are concerned with things like physical movement and, you know, motor control. And, you know, you have a big chunk of your brain that handles emotional factors, you know, you know, the amygdala or hypothalamus or limbic system and things like that. And that we have this sort of, I think it is actually physically smaller, but also kind of more recently evolved part of our brain that lets us do things like logic, reasoning, impulse control. In particular, that tends to be where you do things like project it out into the future and consider consequences. So you can force yourself to do something now for a future benefit. But doing that, so let's say you can exercise now for a future benefit of being in better shape. But we struggle with those behaviors because it tends to be things where the reward is delayed or the consequences delayed, where, you know, the consequence is kind of intangible or it's tough to see progress or, you know, things like that. Anything where that's the case, those tend to be the behaviors that we struggle with as humans. The issues there start to become how much of a delay is there between when I'm learning something and when I can do something with it. And when that delay is significant, then we're using this sort of riderly willpower, my logic and reasoning, to kind of force themselves to pay attention. And your elephant is thinking, hey, wouldn't it be way more fun to like go sit on the couch and watch, you know, rewatch the Game of Thrones finale so we can complain about it some more? You know, and you know, the thing about it is your elephant is right. That would be much more fun and entertaining than, you know, reading about ethical legislation or something like that, or whatever it is that we're trying to focus on. And so one of the things that we do is learning designers is make it more feasible for basically we want to make it easier for people's elephants to kind of come on board. And so your elephant really likes things like stories because they relate to people and they relate to emotions. And how you feel about something tends to help determine how important your brain thinks it is. So, for example, we have this myth about rational decision making, but Antonio Damasio, who's a neuroscientist, he's done a lot of research into people who've had brain damage through strokes or accidents or things like that, who don't have a lot of activation in emotional areas. So they don't feel things very strongly. They don't tend to get happy or sad or angry or, you know, whatever. They report a very flat emotional affect. And in our sort of in our, you know, like our sort of Western dispassionate rational decision-making model, that should make them very good decision makers because they're not influenced by messy emotions. And in
But that's
actuality, they're terrible
counterintuitive,
decision
right?
makers. Yeah, they're terrible decision makers. They can barely decide what shirt to put on in the morning because ultimately, when you are making a decision, you are often looking for that kind of emotional tug that helps pull you in one direction or the other. And frequently, when you don't have any feelings about something, it becomes very difficult to make decisions. Every time my financial advisor asks me which mutual fund I like, I'm like, I'm pretty sure I pay you to like one. I don't have any feelings about this. You know, you've said they have the same risk profile. You said they're, you know, similar in terms of all of these factors. So, okay. You know, and I'm sure he has feelings about it because he, you know, he deals with these all the time and has opinions and things like that. I'm like, I got nothing. So the fact that something makes us feel may be one of the things that says one of the cues that this is something important. And in that case, that's where a lot of the strategies that Stella's talking about, and I have a similar list, but I don't have her cool acronym, so that's very nice. but the fact that we have some kind of emotional reaction to it makes us feel something, probably is one of the cues that we go, is this important to me or not? And if something feels unimportant, if there's cues that tell you that something's unimportant, then you know, like the way that your brain is configured, you're supposed to forget those things because you're supposed to forget unimportant details.
You know, it's really interesting everything that you've said, because the elephant example and all of the, you know, the emotional aspect really reiterates in my mind, you know, making learning sticky or engaging, working with the physical part of the brain, working with the brain, you know, working with dopamine and serotonin to not that you can actually, you know, go in there and like, you know, do anything with that, but helping release the, you know, helping activate those aspects of how the brain works to affect learning. And there's a fantastic book. I'm not sure if you've read it, and everybody, I think you should take a look into it if you're really interested. And it's Sticky Learning, How Neuroscience Supports Teaching That's Remembered. But it's got a lot of great information about the physical sort of aspects of how the brain works and how you can sort of almost hijack those natural reactions and sort of integrate them into your learning design, and exactly how you've said, by making people care, by engaging their emotions. And I also see in your book, you talk about ways to make education more engaging, and one of your top points was be entertaining.
Well, you know, a big part of it is obviously some people have some natural affinity to be entertaining. They're funny or they're humorous or any of those kinds of things. But, you know, actually the be entertaining one is a little bit of a fraught one. It will help your learners pay more attention to you, but it may also turn into kind of a distraction. You can be entertaining and keep people engaged for an hour-long lecture, but maybe you would have been better off doing a lag activity with that time. There's a great post. I can find the links and send it to you, but it talks about sort of pseudo teaching, which is, you know, there was a physics professor who used to do these super entertaining lectures. Like he'd, you know, rig a giant pendulum in the classroom and then, you know, like prove that the physics was good because it didn't whack him in the face when it swung back, because we know this because
I know this. I've seen this.
And, you know, he'd ride bicycles across the, you know, across the like the lecture area and stuff like that. And, you know, to prove points and to kind of establish things. Super entertaining guy. Great. You know, but ultimately, was it an effective way for, you know, for me, who totally amateur on physics, it probably would have been great because I would have been like, this is so much fun. This is so interesting. But when it came to like students actually being able to like internalize their understanding of some of these physics principles, or be able to kind of build on that knowledge and do something else with it, and even just, you know, like long-term retention, like you remember the flashy show tricks, but are you really learning this in a way that you can do something with it? And would that time have been better off spent in, you know, applying a lot of these physics principles in lab activities and so forth? You know, the answer from some of the research seems to be, yeah, probably. You know, and there's also things like Will Tallheimer has a report where he kind of tracked a lot of the research on what he refers to as seductive augmentation, which is you make it shiny, and shiny people pay attention to shiny things. But what you can do is you can actually distract people from the real core material. So they're happily engaged in the shiny thing, but actually in some ways they retain less than they would have with a less shiny presentation, because the actual entertainment value provided its own sort of distraction from the key learning points and things like that.
So it seems like for make your presentation or whatever you're doing entertaining, it seems like you need to be careful with that. Like what, how much entertainment are you by imbuing into your material, and what is the focus of the entertainment? Is it, like you said, the shiny thing, riding bicycles, flashing things on the screen, you know, music or whatever? Or is it actually that you worked really hard to make interesting, engaging scenarios or something?
Right.
Apply the information, or engaging lab activities, like you mentioned, something like that.
Yeah. And people will rate the entertaining things well, but that doesn't mean that they're, like people liking them better doesn't mean that they're necessarily better learning experiences in terms of overall retention and some of those kinds of things. But, you know, I think there's always some benefit to having, you know, some cues that at least help people, you know, kind of allocate their attention. Like, it starts to become something where you have to use it kind of carefully. Like, I think humor is a perfectly good tool. And there are a few studies that have sort of said that if you have, they would use like have people memorize sentence pairs, and people were more likely to remember the humorous ones and the non-humorous ones and things like that. And so there's some evidence that suggests it. And I do think whenever I'm doing talks, one of the sort of strategies around it is to have people feel like they discovered the information, like you're laying out, situations, and then having them, kind of figure it out for themselves, and then you sort of come back in and you say, yeah, here's the name of that principle that you just figured out, or that or recognizing that they already know some stuff or things like that, but being able to then kind of make it more concrete.
That's activating prior knowledge in some
Yeah.
ways. Yeah.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, yes. Just helping people, making it as easy as possible for people to pay attention, creating environments and situations where people can pay attention. And some of it is, we kind of try to move lots of stuff online, and that's great. But one of the issues with moving stuff online is that online is a distracting place, and there's a lot of stuff going on. And so there still seems to be some value to bringing people into a classroom occasionally, if only that it creates a situation where they can, have their undivided attention focus on the new thing that they need to understand. Maybe some of the value in like college classes is, I just need some kind of social pressure or, accountability or something. A lot of times, we can go read the textbook. The textbooks cost an outrageous amount now, but still, it's a
For
lot
sure.
cheaper than taking a college class. So what's the, there's no consequence for
Right. Well, I think
not
that's
finishing
where,
it.
yeah. Well, I think that's where, if we're talking about higher education, where having a good blended strategy comes in, where you're the information that you're asking learners to take in online or do outside of the classroom really connects with what they need to do when they come into the classroom. Just so there's an urgency, there's a meaning behind that, there's purpose and motivation for completing that all that information, so they don't come to class unprepared for whatever activity it is that there needs to be. If it's just sort of passive learning where you're, well, I shouldn't use the word passive, if it's just sort of ancillary learning, how about that, where you're taking information online, you're watching videos, you're reading things, and then you come to class and it's a lecture and you're not held accountable in any way. I mean, there's so many opportunities to give yourself an out to not actually complete all that information. Making sure that your in-class time does have aspects that ask learners to be accountable.
Well, and give them something to do with it. I mean, I think that's probably the fundamental thing. Give them something to do with it. Sometimes I'll say that, like, if I'm giving advice to somebody who's creating more of kind of an information-based learning thing, and whether they should be doing that or not is different, but that the biggest thing you could do to improve that is to just say, so for example, way more often. Try to see if you can say, so for example, on every single slide, and give people some grounding of what does this look like when. How can I tie this to something that you can recognize or understand?
That
So
is
there's
a great tip and so easy to do. Well, not necessarily easy to execute, but so easy to follow. Like, okay, I'm going to try to do this on every slide or something. Yeah.
Well, because people have these things in their head when they've got this expert level, and it's hard to remember that, like, the people who you're talking to can't picture these things along with you. And the ability to picture something in your mind probably is a super important component to understanding. There's a great book called Louder Than Words. I hopefully I'm getting that right. I want to say it's either Benjamin Berg or Benjamin Bergman, who talks about how being able to like picture something, like actually formulate a visual in your head, seems to be a really key part of language processing. Giving people something that they can picture in their heads may be a big part of.
Yeah, and it engages the memory aspect of it, one of the tools of how to remember better, basically, is to connect images and
Yeah, and he has all sorts of interesting stuff about how much of our language refers to like directions or places or kind of physical gestures or something, even when it doesn't. So if you talk about like lofty goals, that creates an image in your head of something rising up physically, even though a lofty goal doesn't need to have anything to do with being literally high. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
It's being able to kind of visualize or picture or understand what people are talking about may be key for kind of that initial understanding. But we also know that if you want to kind of really make something durable in people's memory, it's not just repetition in some cases. In some cases, and I think actually in a lot of cases, it's actually like practice and application. So even more than repetition, doing something with it, trying to use that knowledge to accomplish something, I think is really the probably the most important aspect to being able to retain it long term.
Well said. And with that, I want to thank you so much for coming on our show and sharing your expertise, Julie.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed it. I'm always happy to chat about these kinds of things.
And listeners, if you're interested in learning more from Julie about sticky learning, she has an online course you can find more information about at designbetterlearning.com, along with other resources. If you have any ideas for topics, would like to be a guest, or want to reach out to us, send us an email at edufi@mayo.edu.